dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Those who seek to rule us distract us with consumerism, control us by promoting mindless fear, divide us by causing us to compete in a structure designed to create scarcity, barrage us with meaningless spectacles to give us the illusion of living, or pretend that we share some common bond of Americanness with those who would use us up and throw us away to make a buck. United we stand, and all that rot. My New Year's resolution for the program is to start a monthly feature called the United We Stand 12 Shovels Corporate Hypocrisy Award. I hope this will be an interactive project with you, so let me explain it. First, some context, starting with where I'm coming from. For the record, I am opposed to the capitalist system because it is an inherently unfair form of social organization that ensures that some people in society will be in a position of degradation, and thus it pits members of society against one another as each fights not to be one of the degraded, and therefore ensures that someone else is. Every gain a person makes must be on someone else's back by design. My mother's childhood friend, Mrs. Bauer, was a prisoner in a Nazi concentration camp. Mrs. Bauer, then a 15-year-old girl, was among 13 female prisoners who were given 12 shovels by the Nazi guards and told to dig holes. They were told that anyone not working would be executed. These prisoners, all previously ordinary, decent people, were forced to fight each other for the privilege of having a shovel and thus condemning to death one among them so that they themselves might live. I was 15 years old when I heard this story, the same age as my mother's friend had been when she had been given the choice of killing for a shovel or dying without one. I had heard stories of the Nazi atrocities all my life, but it was not the same as having someone you knew sit before you, show you the numbers on their arm, and tell you such things. The woman in front of me telling me this horrific story was a gracious middle-aged woman with two grown daughters who lived what would be considered a normal, respectable life. My family had just eaten the dinner she cooked for us. I was so horrified by what she told me that I couldn't bring myself to ask her any more questions about it. I just kept thinking, what if it were me? It could have been me. What would I have done? People have argued for centuries over whether human beings are intrinsically good or intrinsically evil. That's the wrong question. Human beings, like other animals, have basic instincts to survive and, on the whole, will respond to whatever situation they find themselves in to do what is necessary to live. What is so wrong about capitalism is that, like the concentration camp example, it puts people in a situation where, in order to survive, they must do so at someone else's expense. And there is no objective reason for things to be that way. I call that an evil system. Competition, winning and losing, may be fine in a game, but life is not a game. The person who loses a competition in life ends up hungry, homeless, or dead. Society as a whole does not benefit by creating losers. But this society likes to pretend the losers don't exist and focus its self-congratulatory propaganda on the wonderful circumstances of the lucky winners. The Nazis in our earlier example had enough shovels for the 13 prisoners. They just held them back because they were sadistic bastards. The capitalists are controlling resources in excess of what they need, which would be more than enough for everyone else. But they are holding them so they can dole them out in an extortionate transaction called the market. What I'm talking about is people who are hoarding resources in excess of what they themselves are actually using. Never mind the 20-room mansion. The owner of the 20-room mansion also owns 3 boarded-up buildings, say, in downtown Washington, D.C. He does not intend to live there, and he has the legal right to make sure that no one else does unless they meet his demands. And I'm not even talking about the sumptuous banquet served at the mansion. I'm talking about the food thrown in the garbage at the end of each day at each of his chain of grocery stores. I'm talking about the piles of goods in stores thrown away each year to make room for the next year's model, in order that no one may live without fighting for a shovel. Every day in America, hungry people rummage through trash bins, looking for food or clothing or other usable items. They are arrested or threatened with arrest by police. I am not aware of any instance where any business or homeowner has been threatened or arrested for throwing away items that others desperately need. Of course they haven't, because they have a legal right to throw food in the garbage, but a hungry person has no legal right in this country to be able to eat. What amazes me about all those people who are very outraged about the right to life of a fetus don't seem to think that anyone actually born has any right to life, since no one can live without adequate food and shelter. I'm a white middle-class person, one of the people with many victories in the shovel war, and I'm angry because in spite of hearing Mrs. Bauer's story, I have essentially been given the same sort of choice. The Limbaugh-esque gas bags who loudly degrade the losers of America's shovel wars like to rationalize a situation by insisting that they, the winners, are somehow more deserving. But the very vehemence and volume of their protestations makes me wonder if somewhere inside they know that they're playing the commandant's game. I doubt they listen to this program, but you never know who might hear something on the radio. So if that's you, for God's sake, people, just face it. And if it makes you feel bad inside, do something to help make things right. And for the record, I don't claim to be a patriot. I think that patriotism, sorry if I offend somebody, is stupid. Patriotism is the belief that everybody who lives within some arbitrary and invisible boundary drawn across the earth's surface is somehow more worthy of being cared about than somebody who lives outside of it. Now, I know this is stupid, because both my parents were immigrants. So, they were outside this invisible line, and then they were inside it. Were they transformed from worthless people into important people by that physical relocation? I don't think so. However, there are plenty of our great patriotic captains of industry who plaster their establishments with flags and proud to be American signs and the like. So, since they claim to believe in these things, it's fair to hold them to the beliefs they say they espouse. So, the United We Stand 12 Shovels Award for Corporate Hypocrisy will go each month to corporations displaying the most hypocrisy, say, for example, by withholding shovels from their fellow Americans who they say they stand united with so that they can export their opportunities for a livelihood to slave labor camps in other countries so they can make more money. Or, like Dick Cheney's outfit, selling rotten food to American soldiers while engaging in lots of troop-supporting rhetoric. You get the picture. I'm hoping that you will help by sending articles or eyewitness reports of this sort of hypocrisy, descriptions of the number and size of flags or similar symbols adorning their establishments is particularly welcome. Email your candidates for the United We Stand 12 Shovels Award for Corporate Hypocrisy to us by visiting the website unwelcomeguests.org. I'll present a report each month on the air describing the activities of the winning hypocrite and post a text version on the website suitable for downloading and being made into a flyer. For those wanting to take some action, you can download and print the text and distribute it to patrons of those corporations, paying special attention to customers whose cars are displaying flags and other patriotic symbols, since presumably they, being very patriotic, would be very interested to learn the facts. This could be fun, right? Tonight on the program, Starhawk on a Dangerous Victory, How Markets Create Poverty with Vandana Shiva, and more of Disciplined Minds. And last but not least, I wish happy holidays to those in a position to have happy holidays, and fortitude to those who must endure them without family, friends, home, or love.
God bless America, that red, white, and blue. When facing anyone with box cutters, we'll say put up your dukes. As we spend $50 billion on bombers and nukes, we're a beacon of light. And just to make the point, we'll cut taxes on the rich and throw the poor into the joint. And we'll bail out the airlines, get out your green fedoras. And for all you laid off workers, we've got maquiladoras. Yes, capitalism will save us, for have you ever seen a more convincing proof than Enron in Argentina? So hang a flag in the window, all hail to the chief. Follow the leader and suspend your disbelief. Our country, right or wrong, you know what to do. Sing, God bless America, that red, white, and blue.
Starhawk is an activist and organizer who has spent decades in the trenches and the author of Webs of Power, Notes from the Global Uprising, as well as 8 other books on feminism, politics, and earth-based spirituality. She teaches earth activist trainings that combine permaculture design and activist skills. She was in Miami for the FTAA demonstration and on December 9th published an article analyzing her experience. It was titled, Miami, A Dangerous Victory. This is what she wrote. For those of us who participated in the protests against the FTAA, the Free Trade Area of the Americas, in Miami the third week in November, it's a bit hard to feel victorious. We are bruised, battered, worried about compañeros still in jail, and grieving for Jordan Fader, a young medic who died of meningitis after this action. We've been harassed, arrested, tear-gassed, pepper-sprayed, hit, beaten, assaulted, lied about, and in some cases literally tortured and sexually assaulted in jail. And we've stared directly into the naked red gaze of the new American fascism. Nevertheless, we had a significant victory that we need to understand and recognize, not least because it throws us into a new and very dangerous phase of activism. Our victory was not tactical. None of our own attempts to physically enter or disrupt the conference were very effective. I've heard rumors that one group did actually take down a section of the fence, but most of us just managed to march up to it and maintain a presence close to it for short periods of time before being driven back by police riots. And while I could list numerous missed opportunities and tactical errors we made, I can't honestly think of anything we could have done, given the overwhelming police presence and the physical layout of Miami, that would have made for a significantly different tactical outcome. We were erect. That is, we were attacked not for anything we'd done, but for someone's inflated fears of what we might do. Shot, gassed, beaten, and arrested for weapons of destruction we did not have. Targeted for who we are and what we stand for, not for acts we had committed. The $8.5 million that was allocated for the policing of this event came out of the $87 billion appropriations bill for Iraq. Miami was the Bush policy of preemptive bullying brought home. There is a certain visceral sense of satisfaction in breaching a barricade and directly blocking a meeting, but those are not actually the measures we should use to judge our success. The direct action strategy in contesting the summits is not really about physically disrupting them. It's about undermining their legitimacy, unmasking them, making visible their inherent violence and the repression necessary to support them, and undercutting public belief in their beneficence or right to exist. And there we are winning, not because of any tactical brilliance on our part, but because, in truth, all we had to do was show up, be there, as a visible body of opposition, and withstand the onslaught. Our most effective direct actions may have been those we did in the days and weeks before the meetings. The outreach, the community gardening, the door-to-door flyering downtown, conducted under the constant threat of arrest by a police force acting like Nazi bully boys. Arresting protesters for walking on the street, standing on the sidewalk, talking to people, or witnessing other arrests. In spite of the major fear campaign and the negative propaganda being put forth by the police and the media, just about every interaction we had with ordinary Miami folks was positive. Locals were told by police that dangerous anarchists would burn their shops, would shoot them with squirt guns full of urine and feces, would smash their windows and destroy Miami if not contained. Nevertheless, local people were scared but interested in what we had to say. The poor and immigrant populations of downtown Miami understand the issues of underlying economic injustice. They could quickly grasp what the FTAA might mean for their jobs. They told us stories of water privatization in their home countries, of 16-hour-a-day work shifts on cruise ships that unions couldn't organize because they are registered in other countries, of their daily struggle to survive on the streets, of the ongoing police brutality faced by the homeless and the poor. When we were driven back into Overtown, Miami's black ghetto, people smiled and waved, came forward to help us, offered places for hunted activists to hide, sheltered our puppets in their backyards. Other local people came forward to offer housing and shelter, to donate food, plants, and time to the mobilization, to hold vigils at the jail and to provide support after most of the action had left town. It was as if the bulk of the population had pressed the mute button on the soundtrack spewed by the media and the police, noticed what their own eyes were telling them, and knew who their true allies were. That disconnect, that gap between the reality the power structure was attempting to construct and the actual reality of ordinary people, is the fertile political space we need to nurture and explore in order to move forward. For it leaves the bullies building a more and more elaborate fortress of control that is unsupported by any foundation of credibility or legitimacy. Where there should be the concrete of credence and the rebar of faith, there is only air, and such a structure is bound to fall. In its fall, it may well take a lot of us with it. And therein lies both the danger and the opportunity of this political moment. Miami was a clear example of the new American fascism brought home. I don't use the word fascism lightly. I use it to mean that combination of brutal state power applied ruthlessly against its critics, backed by surveillance, media distortions, hate propaganda and lies, allied politically and economically, with those who profit from the industries of weaponry, prisons, and war. In The Lord of the Rings, the evil Sauron is represented by a red, glaring, all-seeing eye. To be in Miami in November was to suffer that searing, hostile gaze. The red eye of fascism is a double-barreled gaze, the eye that watches, that records, that holds you under surveillance, and videos your comings and goings and compiles the records. And the media propaganda eye that frames the story, that defines and distorts you, and tells everyone just what the justification is for your repression. For true totalitarian control, misrepresenting facts, telling a false story is not enough. Total control requires control over the frame of the story, the meaning of the language you use, the boundaries of what it is possible to think about. So violence becomes a word whose meaning changes radically when it is applied to protesters as opposed to agents of the state. Violence is simply not applied to police by the media or the political powers that be. The use of sound bombs, pepper spray, rubber, wooden, and plastic bullets, wooden batons, beanbag pellets, and tear gas, illegal arrests, beatings, deprivation of human rights, medical care, food and water, overt torture and sexual assault are properly characterized by the word restraint, as in, the police acted with restraint. Friends of mine who are watching the news on the days of action all reported a similar experience. They saw police move in on a crowd of peaceful protesters, swinging billy clubs and firing tear gas and rubber bullets. What they heard was commentary suggesting that protesters were violent and that therefore the police were justified in whatever measures they chose. Applied to activists, violence means any act of opposition to total military and police control, any act of resistance from walking in the wrong place to talking to the wrong people to allying with other suspects. Above all, any attempts to remove oneself from the all-seeing gaze, to mask oneself, to carve out any space free of that hostile red arc light are evidence of violence. Totalitarian control is deeply racist, sexist, and homophobic, for it depends on division and separation. Police attempted to divide the unions from the direct action folk by pushing the action into the area where the permitted labor march was scheduled to go, attacking the crowd there, attacking union members, and punishing them for associating with potentially dangerous others. Activists of color were singled out for special abuse by the police and prison guards, subjected to brutal beatings and outright torture in jail, in spite of solidarity efforts by other activists. Sexual assaults were carried out on women and transgendered prisoners. Queer prisoners were harassed and mistreated. The greatest victory we achieved in Miami is that these strategies of division did not work. Instead of dividing labor and direct action, repressive police tactics angered the unions who are now calling for a congressional investigation. Our solidarity with labor remains strong, as does our commitment to stand together and support each other through the aftermath of the brutal attacks against our fellow activists, and to name and unmask the racism, sexism, and homophobia we encountered. The overwhelming military force and brutality of the police was a measure of the utter bankruptcy of the policies they were defending. Neoliberal economics, the Washington consensus behind the various free trade agreements and institutions, is not hard to delegitimize because it doesn't work. It promises increased prosperity for all if we allow corporations free rein over the globe, privatize all public resources, and end government support for any arenas of human activity that actually increase health or well-being or quality of life. Somehow the poor are supposed to benefit from this. But this promise has overwhelmingly proved false. Countries that implement these policies have lost economic ground or gone belly up, like Argentina. The gap between rich and poor has grown into a vast chasm. NAFTA has been devastating to the U.S. economy, costing us over 785,000 good manufacturing jobs, allowing corporations to sue government for loss of their projected profits if governments pass inconvenient environmental or labor regulations. The developing countries have not been able to use the WTO or any of these trade agreements as platforms to reduce tariffs for their products or persuade the U.S. and the EU to reduce the agricultural subsidies that have devastated small farmers around the world. Hence the walkout in Cancun of countries from the global south. No one was defending the FTAA with any passion. In fact, brute force seemed to be the major argument in its favor, and the FTAA summit ended in a glossed-over failure. To prevent its utter collapse, the conveners referred all controversial issues back to committee, ended a day early, and pulled back from the original vision of an overarching agreement to a truncated FTAA light, which even in its watered-down form has little chance of being adopted. Their failure was a result of the years of organizing, education, truth-telling, and direct action we've done in the North to create and foster that gap of belief. And perhaps even more, a result of the absolute social disruption that the policies of neoliberalism have spawned in the global South, where governments have already fallen and ministers know their populations will not tolerate more of the same. we in the North are left confronting an alliance between economic powers desperate to retain their advantage in a sinking economy, the most powerful military police force ever amassed on the planet, and a subservient media willing to tell whatever story the rulers command. But the more ruthless and brutal the system becomes, the wider and deeper that gap of legitimacy may become. Our political success and personal survival may depend on our ability to understand and deepen that disconnect between eyes and ears, direct experience, and propaganda. At what point does it set in? When do people start to believe their own eyes? To question the authority of the commentators? How do we prevent the power structure from consolidating a new foundation of belief? How far does that gap extend? How do we widen and deepen the gap? And how do we mobilize and empower those who have ceased to believe to take action? And as the fortress of control begins to crumble over our heads, where do we find shelter from the falling debris? And what new structures will we build in its place? If we can build on the successes of Miami, the solidarity, the deepened alliances, the trust. If we can turn those alliances into real political power, we will have a strong victory. If the combined forces of the progressive movements and the unions and the NGOs can succeed in making the political and police power of Miami pay a political and social cost, we can stem the tide of repression. There were actions we took in Miami that undoubtedly contributed to the support we received. We waged a proactive media campaign. We planted a community garden in Overtown and gave away dozens of trees. Above all, we went out and talked to people on the street. In the worst moments of police assault, there were always those who moved forward to put their bodies on the front line and slow the assault of the stormtroopers. People helped and supported and strengthened each other, and the shock of the violence we experienced was tempered by the sweetness of support and the inspiration of acts of courage. We can go further in making our actions and organizing welcoming and friendly, can perhaps devote more of our efforts to outreach and connection instead of obsessing on our tactics. We can confront our own vestigial racism, sexism, homophobia, and other prejudices that can divide us. And we can frame our actions and organizing with a clear strategic goal: to broaden and deepen that gap of belief, to make strong alliances with disaffected, and to mobilize the political power of dissent, to unmask the violence, repression, and sheer ugliness of the structures of control, to counter them with the beauty and joy of our visions brought to life. Then we can stare back into that red, totalitarian eye and pierce it with a white-hot gaze of truth, a spear in the eye of the Cyclops. And we will have the support and strength we need to withstand the monster's crash and to begin the process of building the world that we want. And that was an article titled "Miami, A Dangerous Victory" by Starhawk. For more of Starhawk's writing, you can visit her website at starhawk.org. That's Starhawk. This is Unwelcome Guests.
Everybody be careful, everybody be very careful, keep watching your TV. There are people who are laughing when they wink or a nod. People who are questioning our great TV God. Everybody be careful, everybody be very careful, stay tuned to your TV. There are ponies who are talking, there are wasters who read. There are people here who do not even own a TV. Everybody be careful, oh everybody be careful, oh everybody be careful.
Everything I know about my country I learned on TV. The man on the screen tells me who is our enemy. They say that we are free and we must fight to be number one. So when the army calls, I'll grab my TV, my car, and my gun. And the TV God watches over me, opens up my eyes, shows me how to see. All around the world, every night and day, on my TV. Teaches how to love, teaches what is real, tells what life is of, tells me how to feel. All I need to know, I can find and see on my TV.
Next. One of the best talks ever by Indian global justice and environmental activist Vandana Shiva. The talk you're about to hear was given earlier this month at Scripps College in Claremont, California.
Thank you, all of you who worked to make me work to come over. But it's a pleasure to be here. When you grow up trained as a physicist, neither poverty nor development exist in your mind, your life, your thinking, your training, because they are totally constructed. And of course, the constructions are many. The constructions of poverty and the constructions of development. I have grown up used to the idea that one should stay simple, that simplicity is the highest evolution of human living. My country, its culture, the civilization was known for this one thing, that we aspired towards simplicity. And the less you had, the more you were respected. The people who counted for most in society were the ones who'd given up everything in terms of material wealth. The rishis, the munis, who moved into the caves, moved into the forests. And they're the ones who could call on kings to do or not do certain things. Theirs was the last word in terms of decision making, precisely because they had left any interest in material rewards. But even when we fought for independence with ideas like those that Gandhi brought to our freedom movement, it was again with simplicity as a weapon that we dealt with colonialism and imperialism. So for us, poverty was a very positive word of chosen austerity, chosen simplicity, both because to leave a small footprint on this planet is the only way one should be living, and also because it was so clear that if you consume more than you need, you are taking someone else's share, some other species' share, some other human being's share. So our ancient texts like the Upanishad say that very clearly, if you consume more than you need, you're stealing because you're taking someone else's share. And Gandhi left us with that phrase that has been quoted again and again and again, that the world has enough for everyone's needs, but it doesn't have enough for some people's greed. Now, that positive interpretation of poverty as chosen simplicity has had many assaults. And one assault has been the way we have defined development, and I'm sure Majid's talk in this series would have touched on some of this. I have talked about this as culturally perceived poverty, where development consultants fly into India in the 60s and say, oh, they don't have pesticide factories, therefore they're poor and therefore they're underdeveloped. Very different reaction from Sir Albert Howard, who is known worldwide now as the father of modern organic farming. And he was sent to India in 1905. And he and his wife realized very quickly that he was sent as the imperial agriculturist. And the job given to him was improving Indian agriculture, which means introducing all the gadgetry to agriculture, the gadgetry of sprays, the gadgetry of fertilizers. And he realized very quickly that there were no pests on which he should be spraying, and the soil fertility was fine. So the soils didn't need the synthetic fertilizers. And he wrote then a book that has become a classic in the organic movement. It's called The Agricultural Testament. And there's a part in it I love, in which he talks about how to understand how to do good farming, he decided to make the pests and the peasants his teachers. Because it was the peasants who were going to tell him how to do good pest control. And he threw away his spray guns, he threw away everything that he had carried with him to introduce into Indian agriculture. But I remember in the 60s, document after document talking about how Indian farming had no pesticides. And that was treated as an indicator of underdevelopment and poverty. Absence of plastics. You know, the idea of development was, of course, sown in 1948. That's those of us which had been ex-colonies were now defined as underdeveloped. But the projects for development, the big money to move that project, really came after the oil money, after the rise in the oil prices, much of which had to be then invested overseas. And the 60s and 70s saw that huge investment by the World Bank and IMF. And in that period, if you read the development literature and you see what are the indicators they are using for underdevelopment of countries, they're actually indicators of ecological sophistication. They're saying, these countries don't use enough plastics. Look at how much America uses, look at how little India uses. Paper, fossil fuel, synthetic chemicals, everything that good societies can do very well without. But that cultural perception of poverty, of course, was not just defined because of a cultural definition of what it meant to be poor. There were economic interests behind it. There were interests wanting to sell the plastics, wanting to sell the pesticides. I know there's a person, I have never met him. He's an anonymous voice at the other end of BBC debates for me. I can't remember his name just now. But he's the author of Saving the World with Plastics and Pesticides. I'm sure you'll know who he is, but he defends GMOs. So there was that whole interest group that thought that by talking about our poverty, they could create their markets. And that hasn't stopped. It's still always our poverty that is the excuse to push every undesirable element in society. The most recent debate around genetic engineering. So far, there is no genetically engineered crop or plant that improves anyone's lives. The two sets of applications that exist are herbicide-tolerant crops and BT toxin crops. Now, the herbicide-tolerant crops have only one property of being resistant to herbicides, which means you can spray more herbicides. And of course, the real reason why these were evolved was because Roundup, the patent for Roundup was going to run out in 2000, and there was a need to have a lock-in for the farmers so that they would continue to use Roundup. And the design for that dependency was created through the genetically engineered crops. The second generation of genetically engineered crops is crops called the BT crops with BT toxins in it. And so the plant literally behaves like a pesticide factory, releasing toxin all the time. It's known that this toxin will do things to other species. Nobody's really studied enough what it does to our health, but we know it kills beneficial species. The monarch butterfly study was one. Indian trials have shown 300% increase in other pests, because when you change the plant, you change its behavior, you change its vulnerability, and putting a toxin in for one pest called the bollworm ends up creating new assaults by the aphids and jacids. But the part I love in the Monsanto trials in India about why there is no impact on beneficial species is because they started with fields that had no spiders, and they put the crop. And there were no spiders to kill. So there were zero spiders to begin with and zero spiders to end with, therefore no impact. And all of the genetic engineering research, there's a very, very good book, I recommend it to you very strongly, it's called Seeds of Deception. These issues are going all the way to the World Trade Organization. On May 23rd, 2003, President Bush proposed an initiative to end hunger in Africa using genetically engineered crop. And then he blamed Europe for making Africans starve by not eating GM crops themselves. By May 19th, a case had been filed, and Robert Zoellick, the U.S. trade representative, talked about overwhelming scientific research showing that biotech foods are safe and healthy. And that overwhelming scientific research is all documented in terms of how every step there was manipulation. Well, it got so bad with this new dispute that has been brought against Europe to force Europe to import and eat genetically modified foods. The European Commissioner for Environment, her name is Margaret Wallstrom, a few weeks ago, she said of the U.S. biotech companies and President Bush, and this is the environment minister of the European Union, it is not a Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth activist. They tried to lie to the people. They tried to force it on people. It is the wrong approach. She ridiculed the U.S. claims that GM was about feeding the hungry. It will solve starvation among shareholders, but not the developing world. And of course, you know, the really interesting thing is that even though there's been manipulation of research wherever this issue has come up, in India, we've had the first set of commercial plantings of BT cotton. Again, in the name of making Indian peasants millionaires, yeah, all the advertisements is about you will be a millionaire. The promise was farmers would get 10,000 rupees additional incomes per acre. They'd get 1,500 kilograms of yields per acre. Farmers got 200 kilograms of yields on an average. They lost 6,500 rupees an acre. Now, about 100 studies in India show this, including 20 agriculture university studies, government of agriculture reports, etc., etc., etc. But the journal called Science publishes a paper saying the Indian yields doubled. Now, the two scientists were not in India to study the farmers' fields. They got their data from Monsanto. And in that book, Seeds of Deception, that's exactly what happened with recombinant bovine growth hormone. That's what happened at every level, where the so-called study was a study using the data the company had provided. And at the end of it, when the issue of science, the issue of knowledge, when it became tricky because there was some evidence, then of course our poverty is always brought up to justify every issue. The most recent use of our poverty is globalization, the WTO agreements. It's supposed to be about moving us out of $1 a day existence. Yeah. I remember when globalization first started to get introduced in India, and one of our prime ministers, Narasimha Rao, was on a campaign trail talking about how if India got globalized and integrated into world market, people would have dollars in their pockets. And women stood up in peasant meetings and said, "You're forgetting we deal in rupees and we women have no pockets." You know, that the whole criteria and yardstick used was so off the mark. But in any case, this whole dollar a day thing, which is, if you look at the millennium, you know, the commitments of the millennium goals of the UN, of after 50 years, how everything would be halved, everything is based on a dollar a day. I come from the Himalaya. And even today, there are villages in the high mountains who have zero cash income. Zero cash income. But they are not poor for that. They have good woolens. This nice pashmina I'm wearing is made in one of those high mountain villages. Can keep you warm, even in the snows. Beautiful homes, lovely structures that protect you from climates that's not as comfortable as your lovely Claremont climate. Food, nutritious foods, clean water. To me, those are the indicators of whether you have the good life or you don't. Now, without a dollar a day, you can have the good life if your ecosystems have not been spoiled, your rivers flow, your forests are intact, your agriculture has not been destroyed, your knowledge has not been eroded, your rights have not been taken away, and your culture gives you the means and mechanisms to organize life in a way that gives dignity to all. On the other hand, I was just thinking, a dollar a day as a measure of poverty, how far would a dollar a day take you in this country? You know, I'm sure all the series of talks you've had on poverty in this country, I don't even know what's the poverty level. $30, $40, $50? $27 a day. Well, I remember, you know, when I had my son and he was not even one, and I had a very prestigious invitation from a Swedish university to come and do a visiting professorship. So I thought, I just left university and I was setting up my independent institutions. And I support these institutions by teaching and writing, etc. So I said, oh, this will be very good. I spend a summer there. I'll come back with enough money to support the institution for a year. I've never been poorer. Because I had to pay two-thirds of what I earned straight for a rent. Straight. Half of the rest went to the babysitter. Now, I've never needed a babysitter in India. When I used to teach, I didn't have to worry about where my baby would be left because somebody would come in the morning and say, can we take him today? And I would never have to think of where I will find him at night when I come back because I knew I could be safe, that someone in the community would be treating him like their own child. The childcare has never been in society an individual responsibility. That is something totally recent, a product of urban industrial civilization. You know, children belong to all. And the moment you have to start paying for childcare, it becomes so costly to have a child that you end up, as you have in industrialized countries, not having kids. It's too costly to have a kid. So poverty is very, very much a function of what are, on the one hand, at the ecological level, what are your systems of access and entitlements to the vital resource that make life happen? Your soil, your water, your biodiversity, out of which livelihoods are created with no capital. The only capital you need is nature's capital. And even today, I would imagine 80% of humanity, if it is meeting its needs, it's when it has that access to that capital. And when that access to that capital is destroyed in the name of bringing development, that's when real poverty starts. Till then, it's purely culturally defined poverty. You know, the other day, someone said to me, you know, I'm wearing a good enough sari, but someone, I was in some fancy meeting in Europe, and a journalist says, you come to these very important meetings, why don't you wear pants? And I said, why would I wear pants? What's wrong with a sari? You know, to me, to have the sari is a much better piece of clothing. Comfortable. I really think pants are like prisons. You know, they're clothing prisons. You know, to wear 6 yards into which you can expand limitlessly. But that cultural poverty of, you know, whether you wear pants or a sari defines whether you're poor or rich. And just as an afterthought, remembering, every time I've been to Africa in recent years, it's always pained me to see, you know, in India, the peasants will wear their little lungi, their little dhoti, a piece of cloth that's theirs, has dignity, matches the climate. And very often in Africa, you see people wearing, you know, all these Goodwill and Salvation Army clothing that's sent, and then, of course, sold. But someone's rejected, leftover clothes. And as the so-called development grows, you in fact see more and more of that happen. And that real poverty is not just a poverty of material existence. It's a cultural poverty, it's a spiritual poverty, it's a psychological poverty. People used to ask me, you know, when I was doing my graduate work 30 years ago, and people would ask me about India, and I said, the thing that's to me most precious about my country is no matter where you go to a slum, you can go to a village, there's a sparkle in the eye. You know, people had a light in the eye. And then when you get the creation of real poverty, which I call misery and dispossession, it's very different from chosen austerity. This is real dispossession, where people have no clothing, have no home, have no water, have no community, have none of that which makes a life. That real dispossession is, of course, growing, and it is growing precisely in proportion to the processes that are being put in place in the name of removing it. Because these many concepts of poverty are getting mixed up. You know, in the name of bringing food, real food systems are being destroyed. In the name of bringing education, real adapted education is being destroyed. But the most important base that is the prevention of real material poverty that's being destroyed is both the actual status of ecosystems, environmental resources, as well as the entitlements to them. Let me just give you two or three examples of the way real poverty has been created in the name of removing poverty and in the name of creating growth. You know, because the story really is, people are poor because they don't have money. Create growth, there'll be more money, bigger cake to share. When the cake grows and there's more growth, there'll be less poverty. It's as mechanical as that. Well, it doesn't work for a number of reasons. The first is because that growth destroys the very base through which people meet their needs. The second is, most of the time, that growth means that growth ends up exactly like it has in this country. You know the figures better than me about the disproportionate wealth polarization that has happened. Well, way back in the 70s, and that was really the beginning of my environmental engagement, the forests of the Himalaya were being logged in the name of creating growth. It started to lead to landslides, it started to lead to drought, it started to lead to women walking longer miles for water, for firewood. And the women came out and started the movement that became very, very global in its inspiration, the Chipko movement, hugging the trees. And the first arrests in Chipko were on the grounds that the women were blocking growth and revenue. And the women came out. I remember a particular action that really tilted the whole thing. They came out with lanterns in the daytime, and I've told this story in Staying Alive. And the forester said, and the police said, you know, you crazy women, you're bringing lanterns in the day. Don't you see there's daylight? They said, no, it's not for the sun we bring the lantern, it's for you. Because you don't seem to know that the real product of forests is not your revenues. The real product is the soil and the water and the air. And I remember in those days, people said, oh, soil, water, we can understand, but this air business, isn't it a bit far-fetched? Well, not after climate change, you know. All the work on carbon sinks is related to the recognition that forests and trees and plants are our best sinks of carbon. One of the first projects introduced into India at the time of the new economic policies that were based on trade liberalization, globalization, or the imposition, you know, basically the neoliberal policies, was a World Bank loan to introduce industrial shrimp farming along the 7,000-kilometer coastline of India. It's not the case that we haven't farmed shrimp before. In Kerala, there has been an ancient system called Cheminketu, brilliant system, in which in the monsoon, when the waters come, the water is used for growing paddy because the salinity is low. And in the rest of the year, when the salinity goes high, those same ponds and lakes are used to grow shrimp. The biomass left from the rice gives food to the shrimp in the next season. And the droppings from the shrimp give fertilizer to the rice. So without any external input, perennially you can keep the cycle of shrimp and rice going. Well, it was considered as low productivity because shrimp was the high global commodity, whereas the rice was used by local people. So the World Bank gave huge loans, and before we knew it, the entire coast was pockmarked with these industrial ponds. And you know, water is supposed to go from the land to the sea, but now water was being brought to the, from the sea to the land so that you could set up these seawater ponds to put the shrimp in. And I'm not going to give you details of the fact that, you know, to get pregnant shrimp to spawn, they don't spawn in captivity. They're freedom lovers. They'll only spawn in freedom. So they pull the eyes out of the pregnant shrimp so that they can lay the eggs and stock these ponds. And then because they want to produce more shrimp, they've got to give intensive feed. And it's such a wasteful process. 15 times more fish is used to feed the shrimp than is produced. 87% of that feed is pollution. And that pollution is then thrown back into the sea that kills the rest of the sea life, kills the creeks. In addition, you've brought salt water on the land, which starts to leach out. And before you know, it's killing your paddy fields, it's killing your coconut groves, it's killing all life around. And the women of the coastal area started a campaign in which I helped them. We got a Supreme Court order to ban this activity. And again, this whole issue of poverty and development came up because the figures thrown up by the industry, by the bank, were the trade figures of what was traded when shrimp was brought to your tables. What was never talked about was the figures of the destruction of what was left behind. And we did those studies for the Supreme Court case. For every dollar traded in shrimp, $10 of destruction was left in the local economy and the local ecology. For every job created in the shrimp industry, 15 livelihoods were destroyed in the local economy. And one could do this for every activity that is supposed to bring commercial activity, therefore growth, therefore supposedly a removal of poverty. But it creates, out of situations where people are meeting their needs, it creates a combination of dispossession and displacement, of real poverty. At the end of it, what you have is a situation where ordinary communities who could have met their needs, were meeting their needs, are now economic, social, and ecological refugees. The dam building in India has created 50 million ecological refugees. And now there is a proposal to create a $200 billion project to divert and link rivers with canals that would leave no space to stand on, with dams that would flood out what remaining forests and good agriculture survives in the country. All of these projects do bring growth as measured in the typical accounting systems. What it doesn't measure is the destruction of that natural capital that is the real solution to meeting people's need for food, for water. And as real scarcities have been created as a result of maldevelopment, as a result of ignoring nature's economy and ignoring people's economy, and in people's economy, ignoring particularly the women's economy. Because if you come to basic needs, you ultimately, it's women